This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into crime stories covered by Odyssey's radio newsrooms from coast to coast. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. Today, we're looking into crime and fame. They have an uncomfortable relationship. While the public wants and needs to know about crimes, the criminals themselves can actually chase the attention that comes with committing a crime. Some crimes are so bizarre that it's inevitable that they'll become headline news. And sometimes, criminals are already famous by the time they go down a violent path. In all of these circumstances, increased attention can change the way criminal investigations play out. On Monday, May 18, 2026, two teen shooters arrived at the Islamic Center of San Diego and shot three people dead, according to authorities. After the tragedy unfolded, the suspects reportedly shot and killed themselves. Investigators have discovered a manifesto that they believe was written by the shooters. It indicates that they were at least partly motivated by another shooter who made headlines in recent years. We'll be taking a closer look at that case and its relationship to online culture, including the glorification of mass shooters and more, in this episode with expert interviews. Another story we'll be looking into is the Mangione case in New York. Since a manhunt ended with the arrest of Luigi Mangione for the alleged murder of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson in late 2024, Mangione has reached almost celebrity status. He even has his own fan club, girls who make their way into his court hearings. Unlike many accused killers, the unique qualities of Mangione's case, including his own manifesto, have received a surprisingly warm reception by some. In addition to providing an update on his trials, we'll unpack his public reception a bit in this episode. To end the show, we'll touch on one of the most famous celebrity murder cases, the O.J. Simpson trial. Mark Furman, a police officer whose infamous testimony was a key feature of the trial, died this week. And Odyssey stations reflected back on how it impacted the eventual verdict. But first, we're catching up with quick dispatches from across the country. Just to note, these are developing crimes, and information can evolve as investigations move forward. This week, our quick roundups are all linked to suspects or victims in their teens or early 20s. Here's a Tuesday, May 19th report from Odyssey Station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia.
A 17-year-old is charged with manslaughter after police say she stabbed her newborn to death shortly after giving birth nearly a month ago. We have to warn you, the following story contains graphic violence. KYW's Matt Coughlin has more.
In court records, the baby is referred to as Jane Doe. Authorities say she was born about 11 on the morning of April 25th in the shower of her grandmother's apartment on North American Street in Northern Liberties. The baby's 17-year-old mother is charged with voluntary manslaughter. She was arraigned and released from police custody on Monday, nearly a month after the baby's birth and death. Investigators say the teen told paramedics she tore out the umbilical cord and stabbed the newborn to death with scissors before putting her in a bedroom closet. Emergency personnel were called shortly before 1 that afternoon, and within minutes, the baby was pronounced dead. According to court records, the teen told paramedics she never told her mother about the pregnancy, and when the baby was born in the shower that morning, she was scared. Paramedics told investigators that while they were in the apartment, the teen talked about killing herself. A hearing is tentatively scheduled for June 1st. It is unclear if she was receiving mental health or medical treatment. The district attorney's office has not yet responded to a request for comment.
Another report from KYW is an update to a shooting that was reportedly a case of mistaken identity.
One of the suspects wanted in the shooting death of a 20-year-old woman last month in West Philadelphia has been caught. Here's KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson.
Law enforcement arrested 21-year-old Zaire Manning for the murder of Imani Ringgold, who was gunned down while walking back to her job after getting pizza. It happened April 7th along 59th and Market Streets, and police believe she was mistaken for being a member of a group hanging at that corner. Authorities say they learned Manning Manning was in an apartment in the city's Morton neighborhood along Green Street, hiding out, and that's where they arrested him without any issue. Another suspect, 26-year-old Mustafa King, has still not been caught, and officials are out looking for him. They hope anyone who knows where he is will call in with a tip, even if they remain anonymous, at 215-686-TIPS. There's a total of a $25,000 reward being offered by both the marshals and the Philly police, leading to the arrest and conviction of King and other suspects believed to be connected but who have not yet been identified.
In Minneapolis, Minnesota, Odyssey station WCCO News Talk reported that two women, one age 18 and another age 19, were arrested in St. Paul by Minneapolis police on Tuesday in connection to the death of a 38-year-old man in Minneapolis. Both women were being held on probable cause murder in the Hennepin County Jail at the time of this report.
Both women were arrested yesterday on the 1000 block of Kingsford Street in St. Paul by the Minneapolis Police Violent Criminal Apprehension Team, a specialized tactical unit tasked with locating, tracking, and apprehending individuals wanted for crimes like murder. 38-year-old Amos Ferrier died Sunday from injuries suffered during that attempted car theft last Friday, where police say Ferrier was either hit by the car or jumped onto the hood as the suspects tried to get away. Ferrier was an Army medic in Afghanistan and was credited with saving multiple lives.
In New York, Odyssey station 1010 Winds reported on a fatal shooting incident involving two teens.
A teenager arrested in connection to the murder of a 15-year-old boy in St. Albans, Queens last month.
It was a story that grabbed the city back in April. Jaden Pierre, just 15, his last moments defenseless at Roy Wilkins Park.
Jaden was on the ground. He was dragged to the ground, returned to his feet, his back against a fence, and was hit again.
Queens DA Melinda Katz there. She says the shooter,
Zahir Davis, as we allege in our indictment, brought out a gun from a bag and shot him, and he was killed.
Well, now he's facing a slew of charges, including murder and gang assault. Before police found him, though, he fled to Jamaica.
But I will tell you that he's here, he's facing charges, he'll face accountability for this.
If Davis is convicted, he's looking at about 25 years to life in prison. He's currently 18.
In San Diego, California, two teens identified by authorities as 18-year-old Caleb Liam Vasquez and 17-year-old Kane Lee Clark allegedly parked in the lot of the Islamic Center of San Diego and shot 51-year-old security guard Amin Abdullah as they tried to run inside the building on Monday. Abdullah managed to initiate lockdown protocols at the mosque, and the two suspects allegedly ran through empty rooms until they left through a back door. Vasquez and Clark allegedly found 78-year-old Mansour Kazaya and 57-year-old Nadir Awad. Authorities say the teens shot at the men and killed them. After driving around the neighborhood and shooting at a gardener, they reportedly shot and killed themselves. An investigation into the tragedy has revealed that they probably met and were radicalized online. It's also been revealed that they apparently had numerous weapons, including pistols, rifles, shotguns, and a crossbow, as well as ammunition and tactical gear. An online manifesto that has been linked to the shooters referenced the Christchurch shooter in New Zealand, who killed 51 people at mosques in 2019. It also referenced Peyton Gendron, the alleged perpetrator of a 2022 mass shooting at a Tops grocery store in Buffalo, New York. Gendron also penned a manifesto. According to Montclair State University, there were 38 references to mass shooters in the 75-page manifesto linked to the San Diego mosque shooters. There were also 11 to the, quote, great replacement white supremacist conspiracy theory. Researchers from Montclair noted that the San Diego shooter's manifesto mimics the form and content of Gendron's. Crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett joined the show A New Morning out of Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo this week to discuss how mass shooters influence each other.
And Brad, the real parallels that people are drawing as we learn more information to the racist attack that happened here in Buffalo back just 4 years ago. And it is kind of chilling to see how similar these attackers were and some of the other details around these shootings.
It's not uncommon for mass shooters to emulate other mass shooters because there's, from their perspective, Brian, you know, this is sort of, they're hitting the sort of the glory part or the high point of their life when they commit these shootings, as odd as that sounds. Supposedly in write-ups that have been found online, I think there's 75 pages that most believe, I think the police included, came from these two teenagers. They talked at length about the Christchurch, New Zealand mass shooter who killed 51 people in two different mosques. They reference him several times, but they also reference your shooting. And again, driven by hatred towards certain groups. Now, what's a little interesting about these two teenagers is that their list seems to be even broader than perhaps these other two mass shootings I just mentioned, where the, you know, they're basically against folks of the Jewish faith, the Muslim faith, folks that are gay. I mean, it goes, their list is really expansive because it's kind of like everyone that doesn't fit, from their perspective, their definition of white is, you know, shouldn't be here. And so, you know, you get to a situation where they have decided at some point, I'm going to guess sometime back, that they're going to commit some act like this. And we, you and I, the three of us could talk at length about, you know, what they were doing online, the access to weapons, all the things that sort of play into what leads these typically young boys or younger boys to commit these acts. They seem to have all those elements, it strikes me, in their life.
The Buffalo shooter had posted in his manifesto about the great replacement theory. Brad, right. He cited fears about a shrinking white population. And it's chillingly similar with this attack Monday in San Diego.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, Susan, big copycat aspect to these folks. Well, let's face it, if you're going to go commit something like this, they're typically proud about what they're about to do or have done. And most of them know that it's a suicide mission, or they turn it into a suicide mission when they commit it. In this case, according to law enforcement, they shot each other in their car shortly after the shooting at the mosque. They attempted, I guess, to shoot at a person working in the yard, missed him, thankfully, and then drove another block or two and shot themselves. So, you know, it's a high point for them. This is like, we feel empowered to go do this, and we're going to go do it. And they obviously, sadly, did on Monday.
That live streaming aspect of both of these shootings, too, it really leads to the question of, I mean, we might have looked at this before, Brad, as just another disturbing detail in a disturbing crime. But now, you know, as we see this more and more, is it, I don't know, drawing people to this? Is it a contributing factor, the fact that they can put this on the internet?
I think some would tell you, and myself included, that it lets them control the narrative. If you think about that you're going to potentially die or will die in committing this act, but you want the world to know what you think is important and what needs to have focus on it, then you live stream it. Like your guy in Buffalo, like the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, we can name off a number of these folks who live streamed, also put stuff online before they actually committed the act, because they want us all to know that they think they're in the right here, and that something needs to be done, you know, about this whole issue of folks that are defined by them as not being white.
When someone holds that much hate, shouldn't people notice? But I mean, at the same time, realistically, what can you do?
Well, I think people do notice, but harboring hate and saying that's against the law are two different things. And until you have information about somebody that's actually planning an attack, and even in this case, Susan, one of the moms called law enforcement and said, "My son has left the house with a bunch of weapons. He's in my car. He has he and his friend have on camouflage. He's suicidal." I mean, it's everything you don't want to hear in law enforcement as to this is going to turn into something potentially. And it, so they desperately go in to locations where they think they might be until they get a radio call, obviously, that there's a shooting at a mosque, and then realize it's one and the same, two teenagers. But yeah, and what do you do about this? It's kind of like, you know, we've developed, you know, massive use of cell phones, massive use of social media, but then we think later about the repercussions of all of that, or the excessive use of both of those, particularly on vulnerable, you know, young kids. And how do you put that back in the bottle? I'm not sure you do, and it's a real dilemma. Social psychologists would tell you that both of these have become so toxic for kids who excessively use their phones and stay on social media hours at a time, will affect them the rest of their lives.
For a deeper dive into the connection between the San Diego mosque shooting and online culture, A New Morning interviewed Rich Frankel, former special agent in charge of the FBI in New York.
Is there a better way to monitor these live streams on social media?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there's going to be an outcry on this one. You know, the what we've seen in the past, and this goes historical, it goes back before live streaming, of course, to where they just would videotape it and then post it, or they would post beforehand, and then there would be information put out after, you know, whether other people were videotaping it or then you went to the live stream. You see that these types of shooters, their goal is to do more damage than the ones before them. It's almost like a competition to them. You know, if somebody killed three people, they want to kill five. If somebody used a fully automatic weapon, somebody wants to use two of those. And so they want to show how much better they are. And so that's why you're seeing a lot of these live streams. And, you know, the FBI has been looking into that through behavioral sciences for years to figure out, is there some way that, you know, working with the online providers or others, that this can be blocked, because that could be part of the methodology to stop these types of attacks. Not that they would completely stop, but maybe if there's no more of this advertising, more of this competition online, that some of the people would not be as aggressive, or, you know, desire that notoriety.
You're hitting on it right there. I mean, has this gone now from something where you might have said in the past just a disturbing thing that a disturbed person did was, you know, in addition to this horrible crime, also videotaped it, to now where it's something that might play a role in encouraging somebody to do such a thing?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I had always been taught, you know, when I was a negotiator and then when we started investigating these types of crimes, you never mention their name again. You know, you say the assailant, the terrorist, you do as little as possible to actually mention their name, because what you don't want to do is say that this guy was the worst or the best, because to them the worst might be the best. So you do what you can to make this as anonymous as possible. Of course, it's going to be reported. Of course, it's going to, you know, it's a terrible thing. You're going to have memorial services and other things, you know, associated with the aftermath. But one of the things to do is just not mention their names ever again.
You know, is this a case where, I mean, somebody knew that something was up? I mean, one of the suspects took their parents' car, took three of their guns, and there's talk now of charging the parents.
Yeah, there seemed to be at least one of the individuals came up, one of the individuals came up in a in prior conversations with law enforcement, that somebody had said that he appeared to be spewing anti-hate crime. And they went out and they interviewed him. And listen, there's, sometimes there's not much you can do after the initial interview if they're not alleged, you know, if they're not committing a crime. And then you have these, supposedly they took the three guns. But from what I understand is that law enforcement, FBI has now searched multiple locations and found over 30 guns and a crossbow. So, you know, how did they collect these guns? One, are they legal? And if they're legal, that's one thing. If they're illegal, how did they get these guns? I want to go back now and find out where each one of these weapons came from, how they were purchased, and if there it was a crime there, then those people need to be prosecuted. If there is no crime, then why is there no record or something just to show that somebody is, you know, has that many weapons? If nothing else, for then for officer safety.
There, it's tied to what's being called nihilistic violent extremism. How disturbing is that for you to see the rise in crimes described like this, where, I mean, it is exactly what it says. It's just some person, not tied to any group, on their own, deciding to do this.
Well, to tell you the truth, I when I saw that, because I've read the reports too, that was not a term when I was in the FBI. At least, and I was in the terrorism task force for years. I had never heard that term. I understand the term. I understand what they're what they mean and all that. But that is how things have changed. Is that is now a term of art in law enforcement and in those who investigate this and study it. So it has gotten that bad that they now had to come up with their own term for this type of terrorism. Because to me, this is still terrorism. I know they're calling it a hate crime. It's not a hate crime when you go out and you want to commit mass shootings. That when you're going around the school looking for the students to kill them, and then when you can't find them, you identify somebody outside those two other individuals, you go out, you corner them, and you mow them down. That's not hate crime, that's terrorism.
Mark Remley, the special agent in charge of the FBI's San Diego field office, said in a statement that the mosque shooters appeared to have a broad hatred for people of different races and religions, including Islam and Judaism. This attack also comes at a time of increased Islamophobia, according to the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Arizona State Law Professor Khalid Beydoun, author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear, joined Odyssey Station KNX News this week to discuss the tragedy in the context of this growing atmosphere of hate.
You know, in one story I read about the attack in San Diego, someone said it didn't happen in a vacuum, and they pointed to years of what they described as fear-mongering, scapegoating, and dehumanization targeting an entire religious community. Wondering if you could just discuss that.
Yeah, that precisely sort of characterizes what's been happening for the last 25 years. You know, since the aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks, the war on terror has essentially, you know, oriented Islam, the religion, and Muslims, the people, as the principal enemies of not only the state, but of society at large. And we've seen this manifested through law, policy, and most emphatically recently through the rhetoric of, you know, politicians, people like Pete Hegseth, Randy Fine in Florida, and as high as the president.
For the investigators, they're going to try and figure out where this came from. Was it exposure online? Were the teens active in spreading hate? Were they actively engaging with somebody someplace else who pushed them? I mean, if it's one of those or it's a combination of, I guess it's easier now to go and find hateful stuff than ever before. So that contributes to people who will go and do something like this because they can go find somebody to back up what they think in their head.
No, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, Islamophobic rhetoric is ubiquitous. It's on X, it's on Instagram, it's on TikTok. If you turn on the television, it's on CNN, you know, across the political spectrum, news media across the political spectrum. I'm a big MMA fan. If you watch the UFC fight a couple of weeks ago, one of the main stars, Sean Strickland, was echoing the idea of banning Muslims. And we know that young demographics, young men like the teenagers who are the culprits of the shootings in San Diego are the principal consumers of that kind of media. So everywhere you turn in modern American society, you'll see the justification and the encouragement of, not violence against Muslims and Islam generally, but the idea that Islam and Muslims are oppositional to what it means to be American.
What would you like people to know about the Muslim community?
You know that it's the Muslim community. First of all, as a law professor, it's paramount for me to illustrate the idea that the United States is built upon this notion of free exercise of religion, that anybody and everybody have the right, has the liberty to practice their faith in ways that they see fit, whatever faith it is. So that is, the quintessential sort of cornerstone of what it means to be American. Muslims are diverse. Our community is diverse across racial lines, sectarian and spiritual lines, economic lines. Many Muslims have been here for multiple generations. One third of the enslaved African population that built this country practiced Islam. So this notion that you can sort of stereotype Muslims as immigrants goes entirely against facts.
I seem to remember when I was a kid, which now seems like a long time ago, there were more parents who would just take their kids around, if they were curious, to synagogues or mosques or Catholic church and just take them in there and let them talk to people. Did we get away from that for some reason?
I think so. And I think your point earlier about social media has really sort of severed the sort of organic human interaction that we had, 10 years ago, 20, 30 years ago, for sure. That especially young people now are siloed in these sort of, vacuums online where they're not interacting with real people. I read a study from 2021, I believe it was, that showed that only 35% of Americans had actually met a Muslim. So if you're not meeting real people, real Muslims, then it's really easy to consume these negative misrepresentations that you see online and that you see on social media, especially young people.
In Detroit, Michigan, Odyssey station WWJ News Radio covered a press conference held by the Imams Council of Michigan about the San Diego tragedy. Here is Steve Mustafa Al-Turk, Imam of the Islamic Organization of North America, Iona and Warren, and co-chair of the Imams Council.
When that horrific event occurred on Monday, the Imams Council, put out a press release strongly condemning the horrific active shooting at the Islamic Center in San Diego that resulted in the tragic killing of three men. We thank God that the school children, teachers, and many worshipers at the Islamic Center were safely evacuated and protected from further harm. At the same time, we deeply mourn the brutal loss of the three victims. Please understand, any attack on a house of worship is an attack on the fundamental values of religious freedom, human dignity, and peaceful coexistence. The Quran, the Muslim holy book, teaches the sanctity of all houses of worship and the sacredness of human life. God Almighty said in the Quran, chapter 22, had God not repelled some people by means of others, monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques where God's name is mentioned frequently would surely have been destroyed. Regardless of the motives behind this attack, violence against innocent people and houses of worship is morally reprehensible and entirely unacceptable. We pray for the victims and their families, for healing, for the wounded and traumatized, and for a future where all people may worship safely and peacefully without fear.
Luigi Mangione's alleged manifesto and diary, weren't filled with white supremacist conspiracy theories. Instead, they were filled with frustration about the health insurance industry. According to CNN, Mangione's alleged writings also indicated that he intended to gain widespread public support through allegedly killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. A manhunt that resulted in Mangione's capture did catapult him into the spotlight. He's been the subject of countless memes and headlines, and he's also made some headway in the court of public opinion. Late last year, 81% of students who participated in a poll by Generation Lab said that they had an extremely or somewhat negative view of Thompson, Mangione's alleged victim. When asked who they sympathize with more, just 17% said Thompson, while 45% said Mangione. Nearly half of the respondents said they thought the killing was totally or somewhat justified. Mangione has pleaded not guilty in separate state and federal cases. His state trial includes murder charges, and a judge made a decision about the upcoming trial this week. Here's Odyssey Station 1010 Winds in New York City with the news.
A major turn seen by some as a win for accused Midtown shooter Luigi Mangione. The judge says the backpack taken from him during his arrest can't be part of the court record.
The judge telling Luigi Mangione and his team of attorneys that he's granting part of their motion and denying the other part.
I find that the search of the backpack at the McDonald's was improper, warrantless search, that the backpack was not within the immediate control or grabbable area of the defendant.
What will be suppressed that they uncovered at McDonald's is the magazine, cell phone, passport, wallet, and computer chip, which was inside of his backpack. But once he got to the Altoona police station and police uncovered a gun inside of his backpack, that piece of evidence will not be suppressed and will be allowed to be used in court. The next court conference will be June 3rd, and it'll be virtual.
However, the judge will allow a gun and a notebook prosecutors claim link Mangione to Thompson's murder to be used as evidence. Attorney and legal analyst Brad Young joined the Dave Glover Show out of Odyssey Station KMOX in St. Louis to discuss these latest developments this week.
Well, this is very interesting. And we all remember Luigi Mangione. We've seen the video where he was sitting in a McDonald's. I think it was in Pennsylvania. And the cops come up to him and he's got a backpack. And this is a great example of what cops can and cannot do. So what the process is very important here. The cops go up to him, talk to him, identify him as the guy that's wanted. They cuff him and then they search his backpack. Now, that's the procedural problem. If they would have talked to him, searched his backpack, and then cuffed him, there wouldn't have been any problem. Why is that a problem? Because cops don't need a warrant to search any area that's under your control because it might have a gun. And if it has a gun, then a police officer's safety is at risk. So they can search it if it's under your control. But once they slap those cuffs on you and set them aside, he can no longer access what's in the backpack. So the judge ruled that part of the stuff that was grabbed from the backpack, which I believe was a magazine clip, and I'm looking through here on the article for the rest of it. There was a passport, a cell phone, a wallet, and a computer chip. Those things were excluded as evidence because the police didn't have a warrant. Now, when they go back to the police station, and they're inventorying what was in his possession at the time he was arrested. Then they found the actual gun. They also found a manifesto. They found a map showing his whereabouts and where he was going to make this ambush. That stuff was allowed into evidence because it was inventoried after the arrest as opposed to being confiscated during the arrest. And that's the simplest explanation of what the court did and did not do.
At Monday's hearing, three Mangione supporters who go by the nickname the Mangionistas were in attendance. They managed to get press passes, something that New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani said shouldn't have happened. At Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, Jason DeRussia of Drive Time with DeRussia had some thoughts.
Defending the murder of anyone, it's pretty disgusting. But yet, a generation of activists have decided that it's okay to kill healthcare executives. A couple of women were given a press pass by city officials in New York and attended a court hearing in the trial of Luigi Mangione. He is the accused killer of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Brian Thompson lived here in the Twin Cities. He's a father, he's a son. These three Luigi Mangione supporters stood in front of the microphones yesterday, and they have like an Instagram account. I'm not going to say what it is. Just minuscule audiences. Although one of these people has a large Instagram following. So whatever, they shouldn't have been given press passes. And on top of it, though, what they are saying, I can't tell how uncommon this viewpoint is. I think there has been an acceptance of violence by people who are extremists. And it, to me, it's just disgusting, and it's a lack of humanity, and it's a lack of understanding as to what actually can get you closer towards your policy goals or society goals or whatever. Listen, there is a political movement, especially, and I hate to make this a generational thing, but it is. It is young, extremely liberal people. And look, the mayor of New York City, who is a Democratic socialist, who is very far to the left, he condemned this, these statements. Even Luigi Mangione's attorney said, this isn't it. But I'll tell you, there are these sorts of sick people out there who think that, oh, because this guy was in healthcare and because United Health denied coverage for certain people, and those people then died, that anyone who works for a healthcare company is a murderer. This is the political logic of just immature, infantile, idiotic children. Grow up. Grow up. To say that his children are better off without him, screw you. What is wrong with people? It is one of the negatives of the fact that everyone has access to an audience now. Right? I mean, and there is this idea that my beliefs are so correct, that I'm so correct, that I have this sort of irrational confidence where I think I should stand in front of a microphone and say that it's good that this guy is dead. Just ghoulish, disgusting, pathetic. I don't know, man. It's not great. It's not great. Texter says, Jason's such a big nerd. His old world thinking gotta chill. I will not chill. I have no chill when it comes to arguing that someone's kids are better. I mean, seriously. And I do think there is a problem in, just like Republicans have a problem with far right extremists, And in Minnesota, I think Republicans have a problem with the fact that part of their base is openly racist. And it's difficult if you're a more, say, traditional Republican. How do you embrace that part of your base, which you need to vote, without sort of taking on some of the onus for being racist? I think the Democrats have this same problem with their extremists. Now, I don't think a mainstream Democrat agrees that Brian Thompson deserved to die.
Of course, the Mangione case isn't the first one to receive widespread attention or to inspire passionate opinions. In the 1990s, it was almost impossible to escape coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. At the center was Simpson, a famous NFL star known as the Juice, who was considered one of the greatest football running backs of all time. He was accused of killing his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman. Simpson was eventually acquitted, and the eventual outcome decided in part by a Los Angeles Police Department cop who passed away this week. WCCO News Talk reported the news here.
Mark Furman was one of the first two police detectives sent to investigate the 1994 killings of O.J. Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman. Furman reported finding a bloody glove at O.J. Simpson's home, but his credibility came under attack during the trial as the defense raised the prospect of racial bias.
It looked a little sticky and moist. Two fingers were stuck to the glove.
The Kootenai County, Idaho coroner says that Mark Furman died May 12th. The county does not release the cause of death as a rule, but his manager says it was throat cancer.
Simpson might have been acquitted, but plenty of people thought he had gotten away with murder after the trial was over. At the time of Simpson's death in 2024, 61% of people polled by YouGov said that they believed he'd killed Brown and Goldman.
Tell me another story, listeners, that grabbed the nation like the O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, we all knew the guy, right? And personally, and we were all shocked. I mean, couldn't believe it.
Not the Juice, not the Hertz guy.
I mean, from USC to the Bills to...
That's Chad Hartman of WCCO reacting to Furman's death this week.
And among the individuals who changed the entire trial, Mark Furman. Mark Furman, LAPD, as we all know, Los Angeles police and relations with people of color, pretty bleeping awful. For some of those individuals, they did not treat people of color appropriately, and it was too many. It was disgusting. Not everybody, but it wasn't one or two. It was way too many. And so there are many Latino and black individuals who felt like, I'm never treated fair. Saw what happened to Rodney King. Okay? I mean, you got to be kidding me. Rodney King, those guys, and they go to where? Simi Valley? Not close to where should have been tried. Without Mark Furman, there's no guarantee OJ's found not guilty. None.
It's a completely different trial.
100%. The belief is there already for a lot of these still witnesses on how race treated them and unfairly and how they didn't believe in LAPD.
The Dana and Parks show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City did an even deeper dive into how Furman and the court of public opinion impacted the OJ case.
I walk in. And Scott goes, Mark Furman's dead. Who would have thought all those years ago that a detective that no one should know his name, by the way, who was supposed to play a little bit of a role in the O.J. Simpson trial because he was the one on scene where Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman were murdered. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first detectives, if not the first detective on scene, and he found the bloody glove.
That's right. He found the glove.
So that verdict was a result, if not the result, of Mark Furman lying on the witness stand about whether or not he was a racist or had ever used the N-word. Doesn't mean O.J. Simpson didn't slaughter both of those human beings. He did. But Mark Furman is the one that got up on the stand. He was the one that found the glove. He was the one that was in charge of that crime scene. Mm-hmm. And they said, are you a racist? No.
Have you ever used the N-word?
No, never. No. And it is your testimony under oath. You have never used that word. Nope, never used that word.
I found it fascinating.
Then they find a tape.
Yep, a cassette.
A cassette of him using that word. And now he is dead at the age of 74. And everyone 76. Exactly knows where they were when that verdict was read and knows exactly who he was. He is the most infamous outed racist in the history of our judicial system.
You know, I found it fascinating, and I did not know this. You told me right before we went on to air that from that entire case, the entire murder case involving O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, he is the only person who was ever convicted of a crime.
He has the infamous distinction of being the only person out of that trial convicted of a crime. Hmm. And the crime, of course, being
where were
perjury.
You? Where were you when?
Oh, God. I was in the journalism school at KU when they read the verdict. But if I really want to ask you guys this. If you take out Mark Furman and the whole side circus of whether or not he had ever said that word, and he is the one that found the glove, is the verdict guilty?
No. No, and one thing I think you're either leaving out or not remembering is at that time in Los Angeles, there was still an incredible
anger
regarding Rodney King.
Yes.
And many people would argue that this was the jury's way of
taking it back.
Yeah. From the acquittal of all the police officers who were found not guilty in the beating of Rodney King.
It was his glove, too, remind me, Scott, that he found at the scene. Mm-hmm. That was the one they had him try on in that backfire.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
They have to be teaching that in law school even to this day. They always say, don't ever ask a question that you don't know the answer to.
That's right.
And they asked O.J. Simpson to put that bloody glove on, and it didn't fit. And do you know all those years later why it didn't fit?
Because they had told him, the rumor is, to not take his arthritis medicine.
Right. One of his attorneys said, you know,
swell those hands up, baby.
Stop taking your arthritis medication. Your hands are going to swell up. Well, and the blood on the leather made the leather shrink.
And they had him wear rubber gloves, which would make it harder to get the leather glove over the rubber.
Yeah.
And yes, don't take your medicine.
His use of the N-word is in the first line of three different stories about his death.
It is the only, I hate to say this, Sam, I'm sure he had a life and maybe he had kids and a wife. Like, I don't know. I think he did stuff for Court TV for a while. You say Mark Furman, I say racist. Mark Furman, racist. There is no separating him from that moment because, and Dan, I know you'll agree with this, he could have said on that stand, I have made mistakes in my life. I don't know. Maybe there's a tape out of there of me saying, I don't know. Can I say with 100% certainty, he could have said all these things, but it doesn't mean I planted this glove. Instead, he raised his right hand and said, I have never.
Yeah, he was adamant.
Said that. I actually wonder, Sam, if we can find his testimony because.
And that's a conviction of perjury for that?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yes.
Hmm.
Oh, yes.
He was, Sam, he was.
And the look
adamant that he had never ever said that word
of the prosecutors when they played that tape.
Yep,
and it happened in court.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so on TV
to the level of, I mean, it was an official proceeding, so it raises it to the level of perjury.
He needed to say, "I do not recall if I'm racist or not."
Sam, he could have said anything.
As far as I can recall,
but
I am not racist.
The vehement denial that he had ever said that word, because the defense was trying to paint a picture that the LAPD was corrupt.
It was quite the distraction.
Wanted to pin this on the black man. Forget the fact that the black man was wearing the shoe that the bloody shoe print happened to match, and there's only 500 pairs of those shoes ever produced in the history of mankind. Forget the fact there's blood in his car. Forget all that stuff. LAPD was racist. And that was the message the defense kept hammering home. And the jury said, all right.
But at the time, were they wrong?
I don't think so, no. I mean, and I think people in that community knew it, that it was so corrupt. And then you have this handsome, remember how handsome he was?
He's very handsome.
This handsome detective get up there. No, I would never say that word.
From the text line, OJ was innocent.
Oh, for the
all love. Caps.
My God.
30 plus years ago.
Isn't that crazy? That's been 30 years.
When was that? I know the killings occurred in 1994 because I had just started at KOFO in Ottawa. And I remember being in the newsroom. I was working at KLWN when the verdict was announced. And everybody, we had one TV in the entire radio station, and it was in the newsroom. And everybody was packed in there. And I remember there was one person in the entire building. Everybody, when it was announced, everybody was like, oh, my God. And there was one person who worked at the radio station who shot her arms up in the air and said, yes, yes, vindication. And I was like, wow.
Wow.
Okay. All right.
He retired shortly after that infamous moment.
We know that crimes like this often have the power to fascinate the public. Hopefully, we can take what we learn from studying these cases to prevent more crimes and tragedies in the future. Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, 1010 Winds in New York City, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, KNX News in Los Angeles, The Dave Glover Show out of KMOX in St. Louis, Jason DeRussia and Chad Hartman out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, and The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.